Welcome back to the Sucks Podcast. I'm your host, Brad.
Oh, and I'm Dave. Hey.
And with us, as always, is producer Joe.
I am not the producer.
Yes, sir.
We're becoming more of the producer every week. That was the plan. Before we did the first episode, Dave and This is not a bit. We started talking about how you didn't want to be the producer, but we needed to slowly ingratiate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Slow burn.
Yeah, into becoming the producer. So I'm sorry to tell you, Joe, that we've been slowly tricking you into becoming the producer.
I have not greenlit this plan. If I was the producer, I should have been able to greenlight this plan, and I have not greenlit this plan.
Mm-hmm. It's part of our plan.
Well, when you become the producer, then you will have the power to veto this plan, but not until you're the producer. Well, so glad that you can all join us again. This is, of course, a podcast where we talk about design, intentional and otherwise, and all the ways that UX, user experience design, impact us all every day. We are lovers, not experts of UX.
Sweet! Secret lovers.
Hmm. And we started this podcast as a way that we can talk about why things were made the way they are and where those design decisions might have gone off the rails. How are you guys doing?
Oh,
pretty good.
Good, Brad. I think your might not as good as my sweet.
That's what I'm at.
That's where I'm at this morning. But it might be a tie. We'll leave it up to the users. They could DM us. Well, not DM us. That's a little too personal.
Yeah.
Just tweet us. Tweet at us. At us.
Sure. Tweet at us.
How you doing, Brad? We never ask you. How are you doing?
Oh, you know what? Thank you so much. I've been like noticing that you've never once asked me how I'm doing this entire
time. Now I have. Seventh time's a charm. Or six, wherever we're at. I mean,
452.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
Right. I'm thinking about after we hit our stride, right? So we hit our stride. This is the seventh episode after we hit our stride.
Yeah, we're getting pretty close to our Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of podcasting to make us experts.
Absolutely. Yes, so, sir. Hey, cool. Speaking of experts,
by the way,
Brad,
you never even let me answer the question.
That doesn't matter. I never wait for the answer. Brad, I actually...
Thank you for asking, but you know, maybe next time you can actually let me answer, but that's okay.
We are going to get to you because I was going to say, speaking of experts, you just came back from a conference. What was it? A tech conference, a podcasting situation. Where were you, Brad?
Yeah, this episode is a little bit different for us. This is our first episode where we have an actual expert joining us. As you know, we are all combined mutual lovers together. I'm going to stand by that. That's not weird to say. Usually we don't claim to be experts, but today we have an expert joining us. And as such, you know, our format's a little bit different. We're going to skip today's news and sort of, you know, save more time to go right into our expert discussion about architecture with Jason Stoikoff. But to answer your question, yeah. I just got back from a tech conference called Pivot MIA. Pivot is my favorite podcast about technology and branding and design. Other than this one.
Oh, hang on. So Pivot is we're number 53. I don't know if anybody knows this in Switzerland in tech.
This is true.
Shout out to everyone in Switzerland. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. I want to be number one in Switzerland. That's my goal.
Yeah.
They're number 54, right? Pivot.
I'm not sure where they stand, but Dave, can you just elaborate on that? Because that's not a bit. That's true. Can you say that one more time?
It is true. Well, Brad, I question if it's true because I looked at it. It was an ad sent to Audioboom trying to get us to buy a service. So let's just say it's 100% true.
I did an email that says that we're 53 in Switzerland in tech podcasts. So I'm just going to run with that.
I'm going to run with it too. What about France? Where are we in France?
Yeah. France, surprisingly, we're number two.
No.
And not just in tech, but in all podcasts.
That's not true.
Yeah.
He's talking through his ass like we do.
No,
I thought it was 176.
Serial season one and then us.
Uh-huh. And then us. Okay. I don't know where we are in the United States, but we're climbing. We are climbing. So yeah, it's exciting.
And we are climbing. Yes.
Yeah. So Germany, you are near and dear to our heart because we were big there. But Switzerland and France are coming up behind you. So you better tell your friends, get everybody on.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's hard to tell when we're talking out of our ass and when we're not, because we're usually talking out of our ass, but we are doing well for whatever reason in Switzerland and Germany. So
and France.
And France. Wait, is that
so, Brad? It is. France is true. Back to your situation. Back to your
So I just got back from Miami Beach. I was there for the week for the Pivot conference, which was just so awesome, man. I mean, first of all, this is the first time that I've gotten out there since the pandemic began. So in over 2 years, this is the first kind of travel that I've done that's work related for business to get out and, you know, meet people in the space. And it was awesome, man. I mean, it was so positive, and everyone, I've kind of felt like we were in similar boats. Like, we were just so happy to be out and together amongst, you know, people with similar interests and disciplines. It was great. And you know, if our listeners, if our users aren't listening to Pivot, I highly suggest that you do. There's a lot of
after you listen to this podcast, of course.
Of course.
Only if you have time. Okay. Now, Brad, were they Florida is different than California where we are. I gather no mask mandates, right? Inside. It's just everybody's just free burden it, freewheeling it, whatever you say.
Yeah, the culture was definitely different in Florida. You know, they don't really have COVID in Florida, which I didn't know, because apparently it's so safe that they just don't even have COVID. I don't think they've had it this whole time. Right.
Yeah.
From how they're operating. But no, the conference itself was felt pretty secure and safe. You know, everyone had to do an antigen test upon registration.
Okay.
And then they gave us individual tests to do every morning.
Before we
joined. So that part of it felt good. But when you're out and about and you're on the streets and you're, you know, in restaurants and stuff like that, you know, no one's wearing masks.
And
even in elevators in the hotel, which I really did not feel comfortable with.
People don't know this, but Brad is always out on the streets. He's a man of the streets.
Hey, man, I got to pound that pavement looking for my next meal. You know how I roll.
So tell us about the conference. What was great? Give us the highlights, because we got a big episode.
Yeah, for sure. We're not going to dwell too much on this. I got to give out some shout outs to the highlights. The speakers, Brian Chesky, the co-founder and CEO of Airbnb. Airbnb is a design-centric company, and its founder is a designer. So, and I think that shows in its product. So that was really inspiring to hear him talk. Really interesting. I got to tell you that they had the CEO of Parler there.
Oh,
and the CEO of Getter. These are both right-wing social media networks.
Yeah.
And it was bizarre and fascinating and shitty. Wait.
What is the topic? What was the conference called? Like, what is it about? Was it a UX conference?
No, it's about let me read the little blurb here from the website.
Maybe we should start there.
The conference is built to challenge convention and features the hottest names in business, fintech, media, politics, and more. So, you know, it was a lot of panels with really interesting leaders, like I mentioned, Brian Chesky, also the CEO of Magic Leap, Peggy Johnson was there, the CEO of the New York Times was there, the mayor of Miami was there, the David Solomon, who is the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs, which is a company that used to work for Dave.
Wow, interesting, big time.
People from Charles Schwab.
So what did you learn?
Man, what did I learn? Well, I went to really learn about, you know, actually went, the real answer is that, you know, I want to be a CEO one day, and I wanted to like hear from these business leaders and, you know, be sort of like crib from how they interact, how they speak, how they present their companies. And I also wanted to learn about technology and kind of like where we are.
Well, Brad, the good news is we have a CEO spot open here at the Sucks Podcast. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we also have a COO. Mm-hmm. And I think the CIO is taken.
Yeah, that's Joe.
Yeah.
All those people are Joe. By the way, let me just circle back to the right-wing social media networks. George Farmer, CEO of Parler, and Jason Miller, CEO of Getter. These guys suck.
We're getting the hot pot here. We lost half our audience in, I don't know.
I got to tell you, man, like, regardless of your political persuasion, these guys suck.
Yeah. How do they suck?
There's so much conflation of freedom of speech and business. And like these people, you know, like these guys, they have no idea what freedom of speech means.
Yeah.
you know, they build their platforms, Parler and Gitter, as freedom of speech platforms. This is nonsense. This is nonsense. Yeah. I mean,
what is Twitter?
These are private companies, and Gitter and Parler are.
But I mean, you could say what you want. It's like, you know, you should have stood up and said to them, hey, can you walk into 7-Eleven with your business hanging out or no? Right. Tell me. Or can you go in there just shouting, you know, the F word to everybody you see, you know, or just, you know, no, because they'll kick you out because it's their business.
Well, there was some lively Q&A, and I got to give them, I guess, credit for, you know, putting themselves in a position where most of the people in the room were not going to agree with them.
Okay.
And to, you know, open it up to Q&A. And I got to tell you, Jason Miller, he used to be the senior advisor to Trump and a contributor to Newsmax TV. He still is. He's a clown. He's not very smart. Where I was concerned was George Farmer, who is the CEO of Parler. He's actually a pretty smart guy. And he seems pretty dangerous, which was scary.
Yes. Anyway. Wow, this took a turn. Okay, so Brad, what was your main takeaways?
Yeah, it was really inspiring to be around so many business leaders and to, you know, hear their perspectives on where we are as a society and where we are with tech and where we're going to grow, and sort of what the opportunities are out there. And, you know, specifically, I just want to give a shout out to Brian Chesky because he spoke a lot about design, and I just really appreciated his perspective on running a company as a designer. I think he's the only CEO in tech who is a designer, or, you know, at least, you know, in a substantial way for like giant companies. So
yeah,
really inspiring for Airbnb to hear about, you know, how they operate and his philosophy on how they treat their employees and their design-centric philosophy as a company. So that was really great. Anyway, that's nice. A whole lot of that.
What about your buddy? What about your buddy, your mentor? I heard you took a picture with the one and only Mr. Scott Galloway.
Yeah, Scott and I got about 10 minutes together, which was really cool.
FaceTime.
So I got some real FaceTime with him, which was nice. And again, he's the co-host of the Pivot podcast, which you guys should listen to. So.
Did you get him to drop? Did you mention our pod?
I did not mention our podcast, but don't worry, Dave. He mentioned it to me. He's like, "Hey, aren't you the sucks guy?" I'm like, "Oh,
right,
yeah.
Right, okay, like, cool.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've been listening. You guys are doing great work. So hopefully, we'll be picked up by the Vox Media Network pretty soon.
Brilliant.
So stay tuned for that. But anyway, that's plenty about the Pivot podcast. And Dave, you're going to have a challenge to edit that down into something useful. But let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with our very first guest, Jason Stoikoff. Hello,
is this Bradley?
Speaking, who is this?
Oh, I am so touched. It's you, Bradley. This is Ida, your great aunt from Idaho. We've never met.
How did you find me?
Bradley, I found you on Ancestry. I was looking on the computer box, Bradley, and there was a nice young man from Ancestry. He said, if I give him my social security number and my bank account and my credit card number and took a picture of my face and my thumbprint, he would help me find my Bradley.
Great Aunt Ida. That doesn't sound like Ancestry.com.
Hey, sorry to interrupt our fake ad read. I'm not sure where that was going. But if you're a real sponsor and like what you hear and you want to contact our ad sales department, or if you're just downright lurky, visit OurPodSucks.com, OurPodSUX.com to find out more. And by our ad sales department, I of course mean Producer Joe. OurPodSucks.com. Now back to the fake ad read currently in progress.
Ancestry, period.
Yes.
X, three X's, Bradley.
Okay.
Ancestry.
Let me stop you there.
Oh,
this
yes,
is not man. Ancestry.com. Ancestry.com is a site designed to create billions of meaningful connections between family, old and new, and make discoveries easier and more
rewarding.
That's
what happened here, Bradley.
So I'm really confused of what you're looking at, and more importantly and more disturbingly, how you found me on this site.
Oh, Bradley, you're there. There's so many. There's videos of you. That's how I knew it was you. And then they're all very dark, and then you keep making us a motion like you're waving to me. I'm like, I see you, Bradley. And it took me a while to realize.
I'm hanging up now.
And we're back. Boy, that was fun.
That was weird.
It's always weird with you, Brad. I was going for fun this time. Keep it weird.
We're going to jump into today's main topic and special guest. Our main topic today is architecture and our guest, Jason Stoikoff. Welcome to the pod, Jason.
Morning.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
I don't know what Brad did to get you into this mess, but we appreciate it.
My understanding that it was money.
Yeah,
that's true.
Lots of money.
We've agreed to give Jason a percentage of a sponsorship proceeds from today's episode, so he's going to get 25% of all proceeds from our sponsors today,
which nets me out negative $25.
That's
today's
right.
Episode.
So you owe us $47.59.
Okay. You take PayPal and Venmo, Jason.
Jason Stoikoff is a licensed architect in the state of California. He has been a principal, a director of architecture at global architecture and engineering companies around the country. And Jason is an all-around great guy, and we've been friends for a long time. So thanks so much for joining us, Jason.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah. Jason, you are our first guest. Believe it or not, after we've done 450 episodes and have been around for so long, we are finally getting around to having an actual guest. So we're pleased as punch to have you here.
I am honored.
And yeah. Jason, we've turned away a lot of folks. Some guy named Bezos, Musk. I don't know who these people are, but they weren't up to snuff. So
I had a lot to say about technology, but we just couldn't see eye to eye.
Honestly, it was scheduling more than anything because they weren't ready to fit within our Sunday morning recording schedule. And we weren't going to modify our schedule, clearly.
We're very strict about this. And usually we have a pajama policy. We're going to let you pass this time, Jason. It's fine. T-shirts are okay. Mm-hmm.
Jason and I have known each other for, what do you think, Jason, 10 years? Has it been that long?
Yeah, it's probably been around 10 years. It feels like 30, though, I got to be honest.
Right. Totally. Yeah. I can't really put a date on when we first met, but it was probably around 2012, 2013, something like that.
That sounds right, yeah.
So my first day on a new job at the Walt Disney Company, I just want to tell a quick story of when I first encountered Jason Stoikoff.
I am so afraid of this, by the way.
Not only that, I'm going to try to do an impression of what I heard. Okay, so they put me down at my desk, and the desk to my left was occupied by this fiery New York guy. And the first time I ever heard him was him just yelling on the phone at some poor individual, just completely destroying this person, whoever it was. And it was like, I sat down, set up my computer, day one, mind you, at the Walt Disney Company, which you think it would be a friendly place. And then to my left, I hear, "What the fuck? Come on. Look, if this is what you can do with a website, then fuck you." Like, Jason, it probably wasn't that.
Well, but you know what's funny, Brad? You know, later on, you know who I was on the phone with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. They were trying to get some kids into Disneyland for free. I don't know.
I mean, classic.
All right. Now, to our users, to our listeners, I'm exaggerating. Jason probably did not use any profanity, although Jason, I kind of think you did. I am exaggerating. But what is true is that he was very animated. He was very loud and it was very heated. And this is like the first 5 minutes of my time at the Walt Disney Company. And my impression was like, oh, guy, this is a dangerous man. This is somebody who's probably going to fire me if I mess up. So I better be on my best behavior.
You know, when my wife hears this podcast, it's just going to validate every feeling that she's ever had about me. So
you have to keep
it's going
to
be good for Sarah.
You should keep her from listening then. But what I would go on to discover is that Jason is an absolute gem of a human being, a very talented designer, architect, et cetera, et cetera. And just a hell of a nice guy. So, Jason, what we were doing at the Walt Disney Company is we're managing big corporate entertainment brands in the digital space. And, you know, to our listeners, if you don't know what that means, you're not alone. I'm not even sure that I understand what that means. But what we were doing is building things. We were designing websites and games and apps and platforms for Disney. There were definitely design and UX as part of what we were doing, but we didn't really call it that. I think when I came aboard, I was hired as a producer. And then very quickly, we were all rebranded as brand and synergy managers. Gross. Brand and synergy managers. I don't know what that means. But what I would go on to learn about Jason is that he had been an architect. And, you know, he had taken this role at Disney. And then he would go on to, you know, be an architect once again with some major positions at some major companies. So, Jason, again, thank you so much for being here. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks.
So there's some overlap in design principles when we're talking about UX design and architecture. Jason, I thought we could start by just asking you, what is an architect for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, right? I mean, I think, you know, listening to you talk about what we were doing at the Walt Disney Company, it makes me think that the term UX is really, if you think about it in its broad sense, user experience could be really a part of any service industry or an industry that's making products. I mean, you know, whether you're making a website that someone's experiencing or a building that someone's experiencing, it's all kind of very similar, right? But what is an architect? An architect is a person that designs and engineers buildings. That's the simplest sort of definition of architect, really. The classic definition of architect.
And do you architect things?
You know, that's a sore spot for me. So I have the, okay, here's the thing, you guys. So we went from architects being architects to now the word architect is used as a verb. I'm going to architect this, which pisses me off so much.
Really?
It's like, and the other thing that makes me mad is that, you know, you have, you know, people that are software engineers, they're being called software architects and then being called architects. It just makes no sense. It's like, you know, when you're a plumbing company and you call the pipe doctor, you call that person a doctor? No, they're not a doctor. You don't go from plumber to pipe doctor to, oh, now you can just call me doctor. No, these people aren't architects. I get it. It's you know, the colloquial term. It's the accepted term now, but it just pisses me off that people that aren't architects are called architects.
So is the term architect now too broad, or do people have just the wrong impression of what an architect is?
No, I think people know what an architect is. I think what's difficult is while other professions have sort of been very careful about who uses the term, say doctor or lawyer, the architecture profession has not. So it's been appropriated by so many different professions now that it's kind of been diluted. But I think people still know when you say architect, people still generally know what it means.
Yeah.
Now, Jason, you said buildings. Could the understanding also be that you design for space as well? You know, I think of things like a courtyard or a parking lot or something of that nature. Are architects involved in that? Is that part of your role?
Yeah, Dave, you're exactly right. An architect, you know, I said buildings is sort of a quick, you know, right, description, but yes, absolutely. Designing open spaces, plazas, parks. And also the truth is, you know, while we're designing structure, the user experiences the space in the structure. Mm-hmm. So really, we're designing as much for the voids and the spaces as we are for the solids.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Jason, can I just ask you this? Primarily, do you work residential, commercial, industrial architecture? Just so we kind of know what kind of spaces you are working in. Both,
yeah,
like metaphorically and literally, like what?
You're right, space, right. Yeah. Well, literally, the companies I work for do large commercial projects. We don't do any residential. I have in my career worked on residential, you know, mostly houses. And what ends up happening is really the bulk of your job is and this is no joke, is a marriage counselor. So when you're designing a house for a couple, you're basically there to be a therapist for them, which doesn't really interest me. So most of our clients are big corporate, mm-hmm, big federal clients. So that's kind of work that we do. So
you're not the first architect who has shared that with me.
Right.
So Jason, do you account for how people use spaces when you're building and designing?
Yeah, that Brad, that's a great question. I mean, really, that's all we should be doing, right? Mm-hmm. We should be designing spaces for how people use them. Now, what that doesn't mean is you don't try and challenge people, like potentially, you know, if there's sort of a standard way that a space is used, it's also incumbent upon us to maybe challenge that and say, oh, could you use it this way? Or maybe the architecture can sort of promote a different use or you know, sort of expose people to an experience that they might not have otherwise known that they wanted.
Yeah.
So while we try and design what people think they want, we also try and give people something that they want but haven't asked for.
Well, that is UX design, right?
Right.
And we've exactly. talked about that in the past on this program, is that UX design is anticipating what people need, not just what they want, not just what they're asking for, but to like really understand how something is going to be used and how to build it to fulfill that function, which I see a lot of overlap with architecture there.
So if I could jump in, Jason, are you saying that you actively do that? Because I was reading an article recently on architects who do this, who employ user experience, where they're, you know, because it seems like it's a top-down process architecture to me versus the bottom-up of UX design, where they're constantly asking the user what they want. It's like human-centered. Do you do that in your role, or do you know people who do? Say if you have a client saying, okay, what are you going to use this space for? And then is there, and maybe I'm getting too far afield here and jumping right into it, but is there like programs they can look at and explore the space? Is that a part of it as it stands in the world of architecture now? Because I do have a couple examples where I've read that they do it, but I don't know if it's widespread.
Yeah, and I think I understand your question, but I think this sort of goes into how technology and you know, digital, what you guys would call digital UX, or the UX that you talk about, is sort of overlapped with architecture and how we use, you know, literally we're using gaming engines to help people understand how they might use the space before it's constructed.
Yeah.
So you have this weird overlap of, you know, they're playing a game almost in a way, like a first-person shooter, to understand the spaces that you're designing for them before they're built. But I think, Dave, your question is, we're in constant communication, hopefully with the end users, and we work very closely with them through the design process, so that they have a lot of input on what we're designing for them, because ultimately it's for them, right? It's not for me. And so the goal is really to understand what they need, and they're very, very closely aligned throughout the design process.
That's great.
So that's a lot of qualitative research. Is there ever scenarios where you use quantitative research and data to power your decision making?
Yeah, for sure. So this is the beauty of architecture, right? It's an art and it's a science, and this is why I love it, right? Because yeah, we can draw pretty pictures and we can make things look nice, but there's a lot of quantitative and data that goes into making a building that works for its user, whether it be you know, what we call a program, like how many people are using the space, how much square footage they need, what equipment do they need, do the walls, I mean, Brad, you know, from, you know, recording studios, do the walls need to be acoustically treated? How many exits do there need to be? And then on top of that, there's a whole engineering component. Is the building has to stand up, and that building has to be engineered, where we work with structural engineers to do that. But architects also understand the engineering that goes into a building as well.
Fascinating.
I would say that buildings standing up, good user experience.
Yeah, more specifically, buildings falling down, bad user experience.
Right. Right on.
If you die using the product, I'm pretty sure that's bad UX, right?
Unless that's its function. Unless that's what it's designed for. Like Saw movies, or even the electric chair, or yeah.
That is part of our dark episode series.
You know what? Wait till our Halloween episode. We'll get into some really dark stuff. Actually, I think that's a pretty good idea. I'm going to put it on the list.
I had, Jason, I had something I was trying to work in, but I just want to ask you really fast if you have any opinions on this. There's this whole thing about architects are now pulling in user experience in a big way, like some people. So I'm going to read this to you and just kind of want to get your opinion on this. CoOffice, an emerging architecture firm based in New York City, brands itself as UX designers for space. In Amsterdam, esteemed architect Ben van Berkel of UN Studio launched a new company called UN Sense, an architect company which explores, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this because I don't know what it is, sensorial technologies for cities. And then one more, KPF from New York City has launched a division called UI, Urban Interface for Cities, which uses urban data analytics for informed decision-making in the design of buildings and cities. Do you have any thoughts on that, like as it pertains to your job and the future of your job and the integration of UX and architecture?
I don't have an opinion on it, but it's part of where we're going. How much it will impact the future of architecture, I don't know yet. But it's undeniable that digital, that UX, in your definition of UX, absolutely is informing the way we design and the product that we're making. And all of those firms and people that you mentioned are really on the forefront of thinking about how that's going to impact the built environment. But I don't really have an opinion on it other than it is what it is. You know, we're integrating it, we're looking at it, and it's going to impact in some way, shape, or form.
Nice. Yeah, I just found it really interesting.
It is really interesting because, you know, it's like we talked about, like the crossover. You know, even now in you know, something simple in California, you're required to put occupancy sensors on lights, for instance, meaning we're using digital technology to know whether someone's in the room or not, to know whether the light should be on. And that's much more reliable than someone turning a light on and off. So even as simple as that, we're already seeing now in buildings, you know, UX being used to help make the buildings more environmentally conscious.
I'm glad you brought that up because you know me, guys, I love to complain. And that leads me into in the Century City in Los Angeles parking lot, which has for two decades been the bane of my existence. They have added those little lights when you park so you can look and see where the green lights are so you can park, which is great, but it kind of, which is a great bonus, a great user experience. But for me, the problem with that parking lot is that, have you ever been there, Jason? It is disastrous. And apologies if you built it. you did not, right?
No.
Okay.
My thing is, David, if you liked it, I designed it. If you hated it, I got it.
You did design it. Okay. But it's like you go down there and you've entered another world and you never know where you're coming up. Like, it's just so discombobulating and it drives me crazy.
It's a bit labyrinthine for sure. I've been in that parking lot.
It is.
Terribly. By the way, those lights don't work. That's another problem.
Well, they don't.
If those lights worked, I think they first started, the first ones I saw were in Santa. But Jason just mentioned that, like, lights in a room of a house being on or off, there are persons in there as an environmental thing. I never thought about the lights in the parking garage. Now, if they work, would actually be an environmental thing, because how many times do you circle and drive around and look for stuff? It actually probably cuts down a lot on driving and actual fuel consumption. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah. You
know, not just a convenience, but literally, I don't even know if that was their original idea was, you know, an environmental impact, but it could happen if it worked
well. I've often wondered, you know, and this must be true, but I don't have data on it, how Google Maps has reduced traffic in cities.
Yeah.
So remember, you know, 30 years ago, you'd get the lit billboard and they would say, you know, 20 minutes to here. Yeah. And the purpose of that was that you would be informed so that you could reroute and therefore there's a traffic equilibrium, right? So that was technology, but now everyone knows at every time the quickest way to get somewhere.
So they're all
has
gone.
That reduced traffic, and has that, Joe, been environment had a positive environment?
Possibly,
Right.
I love all this. I love the talk. So that article I read to you before was from Archipreneur. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's an architecture kind of like a website. And another article that they mentioned, and this goes into the psychology and the positive benefit. You're talking about benefit on society and environment. They also talk about the benefit on the person, which I think is interesting, collecting this data. And they did a study on space, like the space of ceilings. And does a lower roof affect someone more than a higher roof? And they found out, they followed up a study, and I think it was one of these companies I mentioned, I think it was CoOffice did this. They followed up someone else's study, and they said that the lower roofs are for more analytical thinking, but when you have the higher roofs, right, the big ceilings, right, your 15 foots or whatever, it's more for creative thinking. And I'm like, that's amazing, because if you are a creative company, maybe you're going to go with the larger ceiling. And if you're, you know, data crunchers, maybe you squish them. You know?
You
what is that? Being John Malkovich, you have those half floors.
That is interesting.
So, Jason, you mentioned using game engines and stuff like that. So I have a lot of questions about that. I'm going to probably save some of them for offline because a lot of that might be a little inside baseball. But are you guys using VR at all? Or have you heard of other firms that do that?
Oh, yeah, we're using VR and AR every day. with our clients.
Wow.
And it's really sort of ramped up over the last 5 years. And it's a double-edged sword. I mean, what's great is that, you know, our clients can really get a sense of what they're going to be paying for before they get it. Mm-hmm. There's also challenges with it too, because what happens is, you know, you're showing them something. So to design a building takes a long time, right? It takes months. There's a lot of things that you need to do to design a building. You know, you've got to work out the space planning, how it's going to be used, and you go into what construction materials you're using. Then you're doing structural calculations and you're detailing. There's a lot that goes into it, right? Then you go to the city and get a plan check. So what happens with the technology is it's so fast that our clients now are expecting us to iterate on designs much, much more quickly than we used to. Yeah. And what's interesting is particularly working for tech clients, like, you know, I've worked with Google, worked with Facebook, you know, they're expecting the building design to sort of follow a more agile flow because that's what they use. Mm-hmm. And so what you end up doing is you end up designing a building 40 times, which works great for code and software, doesn't work great for a building, right? So it's been really challenging for us to have to show our clients very early in the process what the building might look like before we've really been through a design process.
Yeah, you know, I do think that in general, even in software and product design, digital product design, there is a dark side to agile design. And it's not, I don't think it's the complete answer. I will give you guys a prediction that in 5 years from now, agile as a term might be a little outdated and it'll be replaced by something else. But I think we'll probably do a whole other episode on that. We have an episode coming up, just to plug this, with a with an actual de facto product manager, and I think we'll spend a lot of time talking about agile design in that one. So that's getting people to already click that unsubscribe button from this podcast. So
I unsubscribed mentally.
Oh my gosh! But right after that agile design episode, we have Lord. Yeah, Elon Musk's spouse, Lord, on the podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, with an E, right? Not the Lord, our Savior. You're talking about the
oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
We should get him,
guys,
yeah.
We should get Jesus. Can you imagine?
Yeah, like
world building. Jesus Christ to talk about world building? Oh, my gosh.
What's the user experience with that?
Oh, my gosh. We can save it for, like, Easter or something like that. We're going to be coming up on Easter, and we're going to have Jesus as a guest.
Oh, Lord.
I think I'm really pissing some people off.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Okay. All right. So,
I don't know if we're going to keep that in.
I think, you know, the thing is, that I think, Brad, you mentioned to me offline that this podcast is bigger than Jesus. You said that, right?
Yeah. No, bigger than the Beatles, which is bigger than Jesus.
Which is bigger than Jesus.
So we're a couple steps up, okay?
Wow. Well, this has certainly taken a turn. Let's get us back on track.
Yes.
So one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Jason, was about permanence and impermanence in design. And, having worked in digital and in physical spaces, digital design is really probably meant for a max of 5 years. You know, that's maybe like the max life cycle of a digital product for the most part. That's an oversimplification. But architecture is designed for permanence. And when you're designing a building or a structure or a space, do you have like a life cycle in mind?
Yeah, I mean, we design, you know, that's a good point, right? Sort of what you do in the digital space is a little more transient, expected to be replaced sooner. I think, you know, the cost of building a building, I think it's as much economic driven as it is anything else, right? The cost of developing a building is such the investment has to last a long time, right? And plus, buildings last a long time. So absolutely, when we're designing buildings,
or they should.
Yeah, or they should. When we're designing buildings, you know, it's very important that we know that is going to be, you know, maybe experienced by a lot of people over a lot of years. So, you know, being sensitive to the context, being sensitive to people that might use it in the future that you weren't designing it for. You know, for instance, right now, a lot of us are looking at how to design parking structures so that in the future they can be converted to office buildings or other uses, right? So that's something that we're we're looking at now from a sustainability perspective, you know, knowing that the buildings are going to last a long time, how do you design for that impermanence?
Well, Jason, that brings up another great kind of discussion point for us is that, you know, with culture changes, architecture and spaces need to be adaptable as well. So I'll give you an example. You know, after coming out of the pandemic, I hate it when people say coming out of the pandemic because it never feels like we're coming out of the pandemic, you know, but coming out of the pandemic, there's probably a lower need for commercial building spaces. Fewer people are going to be working out of the office in general. And I don't know that that's ever going to go back to pre-pandemic levels. I think there's going to be people who just work from home forever for, you know, and what does that mean for commercial real estate? What does that mean for all these office spaces? Let's say that I'll make up a number. We need 20% fewer office commercial real estate than we did 5 years ago. And how do we adapt those spaces? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, we, you know, the past 2 years, that has been the question, right? What's going to happen to spaces, architecture, cities? You know, I'll take that question a step back, and it starts to bring into question, you know, a city like New York City and Manhattan, where, you know, it's super dense. There's a reason. There was a reason for that, right? You know. Businesses need to be near each other to produce and to work. You know, the past 2 years has really thrown not only buildings, you know, specifically office buildings, but it's thrown the whole idea of what a city is into question. I mean, you know, we've seen people doing their jobs now from all over the world. So what does it mean to necessarily have to be in a geographical location to do your work? We don't know the answers yet. That's going to, you know, the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think that's going to start to shake out in terms of what that means to the built environment.
So potentially, you know, there could be more green spaces in cities and less and more people doing work, you know, in traditional, you know, like exurban or rural spaces.
Yeah, Joe. I mean, exactly. And you know, pre-pandemic, the thinking was, you know, we need to densify because it's better for the environment, right? So when you densify, there's less cars, less, you know, emissions, better for the environment. Now, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe you don't densify. Maybe you spread out, but then you don't have to drive into a central location. So there potentially could be more open space, more quote unquote, you know, organic or nature spaces.
Right. Yeah. And Jason, all of us here, the four of us are all in Los Angeles. And as the pandemic spiked and the need for commercial real estate has plummeted, the unhoused have, you know, there's been more and more unhoused people who are experiencing homelessness. And, you know, the optimist in me thinks that these problems are mutually solvable together. We've needed less commercial real estate. We need more residential real estate. Why can't we find like a happy balance here? Why isn't, you know, the answer to one the answer to the other? You know, and I know there's a lot of complexities with that, but for all of you guys, have you guys thought about that?
I think it's a political will and an economic issue. Like, people don't, I mean, somebody has to pay for that. So that's probably going to have to come from taxes, and then somebody actually has to administer that. So it's, if there's no, there's no public will, then there's no political will.
Yeah, I don't. It's so complex of an issue. Brad, I don't know. You put me on the spot here. Yeah. I'm going to kick it right over to Jason.
Well, I was really hoping that we could solve the homeless problem.
Oh, great.
This morning. So if we could just, you know, take 5 minutes and just solve that, I think that would be great.
Yeah. You know, well, what I'm thinking about is, you know, when you say that, Brad, when you say less need for office, theoretically more space for housing, I think what I think about is maybe as we sort of are able to be more in the diaspora, maybe that somehow reduces land value in a good way. So if everyone doesn't need to be in LA,
right,
then maybe land value or real estate value drops, making it a more accessible solution and a more accessible political will if the economics of it is a little bit better. So maybe in the next 30 years, if real estate value drops because, you know, the need to be close together doesn't exist, then maybe there's more opportunity for a political will to house homeless because it's more economically feasible.
Here's another problem too. Are you guys familiar with the NIMBY problem?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the not in my backyard. right now people are spending so much for their own homes and apartments and such that, you know, the public doesn't want in my backyard.
You're talking about Dave Chappelle.
Oh yeah,
that's have you news. Heard about this? Yeah, we should put that in news. Yeah, I think I don't want to talk about it too much, but I think he was misrepresented a little, but maybe not probably. Much because he got dragged for this. But apparently, he went to a city council and was like, "Killed a bill," because he's like, "I'm not gonna put in my investment into this city, to this town I've lived in. If you build this lower income like housing
right.
situation, now right. I could be misrepresenting that entirely. I think
you're right because the NIMBY problem goes beyond just this. I mean, it's." You know, it's all kinds of like nobody wants waste management in their backyard. Nobody wants electric plants in their, right. which is why a lot of this stuff gets pushed to lower income neighborhoods. Why highways get routed through lower income neighborhoods while you know, power lines and cell phone towers aren't, you know.
Irvine versus Inglewood, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You take those airports in Santa Ana and you just go straight up like a spaceship.
Yes.
But over Inglewood, they're just hitting the tips of the roofs coming in.
Yeah. Well, the irony about the Dave Chappelle thing is that, you know, he's from and lives in Yellow Springs, Ohio, which is about 20 minutes from where I was born and grew up. And there's so much space there. Right. It's all farm country. There's so much room for, you know, low income housing and all that. It's too bad. And I don't want to mischaracterize anything because I'm not an expert on this, the ins and outs of the City Commission of Yellow Springs and what they're actually proposing.
Yeah. Yeah. Same, right. same here. That's why I was kind of.
But I can tell you that there's the
Yellow Springs is a little bit of an art community. They kind of want to keep it, you know, like exclusive and.
Yeah, I don't know his reasoning. I think there was more to it. Like, this is one of the things you see on Twitter. It blows up, and then you get the headline, and then you're like, "Oh, he's a terrible person." And then you're like, "It's Dave Chappelle, though. It doesn't sound like something he'd do." And then I saw like one tweet where the dude is like, "And this is the bad side of Twitter, guys. You guys always give me shit.
There's a bad side of Twitter.
this is the bad side because I wanted to get into it and I never did. So the headline, but it's a bad thing about news too, right? I mean, you can catch a headline on the news.
There's something bad about news.
So now I feel compelled to look into this Dave Chappelle thing while you guys talk about architecture. Carry on.
Okay.
You know, this is why, and I'm going to tip my political hand a little bit here, but this is why you need regulation, right? And this is why you need government to somehow, because what happens is in our great capitalist country, the only way you're going to get really people to build affordable housing is if you mandate it, or alternatively, if you give them incentives to do so, right? So this is what happens today, right? Basically, if you're a developer in some communities and you want to build an apartment building, you have to build a certain percentage of affordable housing, right? And that's how affordable housing is built. So the NIMBY idea, you know, it can't just be left up to the people. Otherwise, you're not going to have anything for anybody because no one wants it in their backyard. I mean, the truth is I don't want it in my backyard, right? Because I don't want it in my backyard because if everyone says not in my backyard, then why do I have to suffer for it? Or why do my property values have to lose because of that? So you need regulation. You need the government to help us provide that for people.
Yeah, we're having the exact same. In my town, we had the same situation. People were living in a park and it was getting unmanageable because, you know, it was a pretty popular park kids were playing in. And then they wanted to force them out. And there was a law in the books that said, you know, they can sleep. You know, there were certain times where they essentially their hands were tied. They couldn't really kick them out. So somehow they put them into a facility temporarily. And then the plan was to build housing. But then everybody was like, no, not in my backyard. Like you brought up, Joe, this is a great topic. And it's like, okay, but you don't want them sleeping in the park, but you don't want them in a home. So what do you want to do? Like so many communities have done and just bus them to downtown LA. And then everybody driving into LA wants to complain about Skid Row. So it's kind of like a game of hot potato.
Yeah,
it totally
this
is.
This is one of the most heartbreaking. This is one of the most heartbreaking problems that we as a society face, in my opinion, right now. I mean, it really should like kind of wreck all of us. And even Dave, not to put you on blast really, but how you were just referring to it as them in quotes, right? It just kind of rubs me the wrong way. I'm not really putting you on blast.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just saying, a group of people, it's them.
but you know,
and you know what? You know what? If we're not just wearing our hearts on our sleeves, this is going to make me sound like a prick, but I don't intend it to.
Yeah.
Getting into UX, there's a whole, like, you can't just go, okay, let's build homes and put folks into homes, right? There's also that people have drug issues. People have psychological issues.
Yes.
People have employment issues. Like, if you have a felony and you can't get a job, there's so many things that go into why folks are homeless that you have to solve in addition to the people who don't want them living near them, or the taxpayer money that's not there that you need to make available.
Right.
So that's why I said I don't even want to touch it, because it's so complex.
Yeah.
It is.
But it doesn't seem like anybody has the will to kind of sit down, everybody come to the table and go, let's solve this.
I really wish that we would, because it does feel like it. There are solves. Now, I don't think it's like a blanket solve. It's just that we convert commercial real estate into, you know, housing for the unhoused.
Right.
I don't think that's it, but I think that it could be like 100 things.
Well, I was going to say, and Jason can speak to this too. I mean, what are zoning ordinances like in LA? Because it seems very strange, because sometimes you will drive down, a residential neighborhood, and then suddenly there's a bunch of commercial space. But I don't think it's just as easy to turn commercial space into residential space because of, you know, zoning laws.
Yeah, you know, Joe, you're right. Zoning ordinances really dictate what uses you can put where. And you know, zoning ordinances were created so that, you know, you could keep a sort of consistent use and character of a neighborhood. But in a lot of ways, there are also impediments to sort of solving some of these problems as well, right? So it's absolutely as much of a political, it's really mainly a political and economical issue, where we have to start writing better zoning ordinances such that we can solve these problems more easily. Because I agree, we even though it's a complex problem, the homeless problem is something that we can solve if there's the political will for it.
That's right. And to our listeners who aren't in Los Angeles, Jason, I don't know if you know this, but we over-index in Germany for whatever reason. This is true.
Is that still true? Yeah. Are you keeping tabs on it?
Yeah, man. I check the analytics every day, of course.
Brilliant.
So for our sponsors, we need to know what to charge for these spots. So anyway, for our listeners and users who are not in Los Angeles, it's hard to overstate what a huge problem this is in cities like LA. Rewind like a year and a half ago, it was very, very visible, even in my quiet little community here. When you were driving down the street, you could see the unhoused set up in tents on sidewalks. And I don't know what's more disturbing, the fact that it was visible a year ago, or is it more disturbing that it's no longer visible? That's actually scarier to me. Like, okay, so they have done something to, you know, kick these people out. Where do they go? And that probably is worse at the end of the day. I mean, it's just like, just because we can't see it, it's still there, and it's probably much worse.
Yeah.
I would like to mention that Germany has seen 150% increase in homelessness since 2014, and their next government is promising to end homelessness by 2030.
Okay.
Mm. Just a shout out to our German listeners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so Jason's got something for us, right? Jason, you came prepared. I love it. What a great guest.
Yeah, no, I thought it'd be interesting, if I threw out a few things, I'd like to get your opinion on if you think it sucks or not sucks. And this, most of the things I'm going to throw out are, architecture-related things. So I'm just going to, it's kind of like free association. I'm going to throw something out,
great.
And then I'm going to go around the room, and we're going to say sucks or not sucks.
Before
and
you do,
maybe you can tell us why we're right or wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before you do, Jason,
yes.
I think this is a perfect moment for our Sucks or Not Sucks theme song.
Sucks! Not suck!
That was amazing. So, okay, here we go. I'm going to throw something out. I'm going to go around the room. Don't think too hard about it, and then we'll talk about it. McMansions, Brad.
Sucks.
Joe.
Sucks.
Dave.
Fun.
No, it sucks.
Like that. the pyramids in Egypt, Joe.
Don't suck.
Dave.
Sucks for the slave labor.
Love it. Brad.
Yeah, I'm not big on slave labor, so I'm going to say sucks.
Okay. The original World Trade Center in New York City, Brad, sucks, not sucks.
I don't know. I always thought it was a little like communist block looking.
Okay. Dave.
I can never forget. I got to say not sucks,
Joe.
Brad, what you're talking about is brutalist architecture, and I'm going to say not sucks.
Okay. Yeah, I think I need to change my answer.
Brad, not a fan of the World Trade Center.
You know, I'm changing my answer to doesn't suck.
Yeah, too late.
So it's interesting, right? So if you think about something like the pyramids, David, you said it exactly right. Like, you know, does it suck or does it not suck? The truth is, you know, there's the old joke, you know, after hundreds of years of slave labor, right? Like tens of thousands of slaves moving these blocks 1 inch at a time. And, you know, 200 years into it, one of the slaves gets up the courage to ask the Pharaoh, like, sir, what are we building this for? And the Pharaoh says, oh, you know, when I die, just put me in there. So it's
wow.
It's absolutely sucks, not sucks in terms of UX. Absolutely depends on your perspective and who you are, right?
Right.
So if you're the Pharaoh, boy, the pyramids are fucking great, right? Yeah. It doesn't suck. Look at this. I'm going to keep going there.
Is that true, though, Jason? Like, because you don't get to experience until you're dead. I guess it's an ego boost. It's like, look at that big triangular penis in the sky for me.
Right. It's like, that's exactly what it is.
I'm a
but
boss.
If you're the slave, it sucks, right? Yeah. So the, you know, we'll get to McMansions, but I do want to touch on the World Trade Center because I think that's interesting too. Because
well quickly before we move on to anything else, let's finish pyramids. From a non-emotional standpoint, just from a design standpoint, I mean, engineering wise, I mean, they're incredibly strong. They've lasted for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. They did amazing things with like transmitting light through space. From a purely design perspective, I would
say. Are you talking about the movie Stargate?
What?
Transmitting light through space? Explain, please.
No, like
he's thinking when we say pyramid, he's thinking of the Luxor in Vegas. That's what Joe thinks that the pyramids is the pyramid on Las Vegas Boulevard shooting that big light into space.
Oh wow, that does transmit light into space, doesn't it? I didn't even think of that. But I mean, because they built like channels, I guess, into the side so that there would actually be light inside to work and move. Like, the design of having light transmitted through space is an important design element. Like, nobody likes dark spaces.
You meant outer space.
That's what we thought too, Joe. That's brilliant. So he needs light through space. Got it. Okay. Yes. You are redeemed. See,
Joe, I hear you.
We get there.
Let me see if I can jump on what Joe's saying. So from the outside, they seem really simple, right? Just a big pyramid, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like a pyramid is what shape is a pyramid? It's a pyramid. Yeah. But what you're saying is there's much more complexity than you think. Whether it be, you know, the sort of false, you know, I know that there was mazes and those things and whatever, but it's really interesting, right? But also it's another point about, you know, how you're viewing UX depends on how you're perceiving it, and therefore does it suck or not suck?
Right.
So what you're saying is these things are much more complex than you think, which is really interesting to me.
Right.
So let's are we done with pyramids?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about the World Trade Center. You know, the World Trade Center is really interesting because those buildings really became, you know, they're very austere, they're very efficient. You know, the floor plates didn't have columns. You could fit a lot of people in them. They really became those buildings, you know, in my opinion, that were actually beautiful, really became a symbol of the sort of excesses of American capitalism, right? And so those buildings, while you may be a, you know, a landlord or a business in the United States, were really great. In some parts of the world, to some maybe extremist groups, those buildings really became a symbol of the excess of American capitalism. So it really hammers home the idea that it depends on your perspective. It depends on who you are. And really, in terms of UX design, super important, you know, whether you're designing a building or a website, that you understand who's using it and what that perspective is going to be in the world.
Cheers to that. Nothing to add. Brilliantly said. So let's pivot back to McMansions. And Jason, we all answered in the negative that McMansions suck. Can you tell us why?
Yeah. Now, I think this is one of those situations where I almost might say they objectively suck. But in sort of thinking about this episode, I was thinking, why? Why do they suck? You know, what is it about them? And when we say McMansion, I think what we mean is this sort of big... sort of pastiche of what a house, what a big house, what people expect a big house to look like, right? Uh-huh. It's got a lot of windows. it's usually on a piece of land that's not that expensive, meaning these things are built sort of cheaply.
Yep.
So why do I not
typically on a smaller plot of land too? Because it's like they'll buy and then subdivide a plot of land and basically give, you know, a 4,000 square foot house, 5,000 square foot lot, and call it a day, and then put another one 200 feet right next to it.
Yeah, totally. Joe, that's a great point, because if you look at, you know, if you look at more affluent neighborhoods and the pieces of land that these large houses are on, the land is commensurately bigger for the house. So you're exactly right, right? It's like that's, and I didn't even think of that. It's these huge houses put on these small plots of land, which almost is so comical. It becomes, and this is why I think I don't like them, it becomes a characterization of what we think the American dream is. From a UX perspective, you know, is it a better experience? No, right? Is it someone trying to impress? Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's almost become, and it's funny, Brad, that you mentioned Vegas, because that's what Vegas is, right? Right. Vegas is, and we know this about Vegas. Vegas is a characterization of a lot of different things, right? It's like derivative of a lot of different things. But you go to Vegas knowing that, right?
Right.
But you don't want your home to be Vegas. Like, if I'm going to build a McMansion, why don't I just build a house that looks like New York, New York, but just like much smaller, right? Like, it's the same thing.
It's kind of the same thing.
I'm going to build my house to look, and I'm going to have a mini Eiffel Tower out in front, right? Same thing. It's ridiculous.
I also think that a characteristic of a McMansion is that they are intended to dominate nature. They're intended to dominate the space in which they're built in, as opposed to be incorporated into nature, which is like a characteristic, like, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, the most famous architect in the world. That was one of his sort of operating principles, right? To either integrate or to deliberately stand out, but not to dominate, right?
Yeah, and I think what you're saying, Brad, I think the important thing to say there is it's acknowledging its context. Has a statement about that, right? And whether it be Frank Lloyd Wright with Falling Water that sort of integrates organic with nature, or the Guggenheim, which doesn't.
But or the prairie design houses that really kind of fit into that landscape as well. Wasn't his design school was actually like built in that prairie style, like on the property that it was built on.
Right. Yeah. There's a famous story about Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, whether it be true or not, I don't know, but with, you know, Falling Water is a famous house in Pennsylvania that Frank Lloyd Wright designed. But there's a story that when he was commissioned to design that house, he literally sat and stared at the site plan, or for all of our Gen Zers, the Google Earth photo of the site. And he sat and stared at it for a year, didn't do anything, didn't draw anything. And then all of a sudden, one weekend, designed the whole house. Which, you know, true or not, it's interesting, right? Because it's really a statement about the house really was generated from his thoughts about the site and Brad, what you call nature. Or so it's fascinating to think that, you know, UX or user experience as something that could be really well integrated with our current environment, our context, our daily lives. Mm-hmm. And so on. And this is what McMansions don't do, right? I mean, you know, I'd written something, if you just indulge me, I'll just sort of have to sort of re-talk this. But it's really, you know, the American dream has really become an arms race. You know, you start with the tenement houses in New York City, super dense. And then you go, you know, post-war suburbs, right? Everyone wants their space. So in New Jersey, everyone wants a little plot of land. I mean, then you keep going to the sort of waterless sprawl of Phoenix, right? So this is just the American dream, like layer upon layer of this escalation, this arms race. And the McMansions really are, you know, in my opinion, are just sort of a depressing view into the what I call the valueless escalation of the American dream.
That's a good way to put it. Let me tie it back to user experience. And this is more the subjective viewpoint of McMansions, but you mentioned like you're trying to impress. Who are you trying to impress? The guy who has the exact same house, you know, 50 feet away, who knows exactly how much you spent, exactly how it was designed, because he picked out the same floor plan that you did, but also the actual experience of living there. It seems like you don't actually use the house because to afford it, you have to work in the city. And then you end up spending like 6 hours like commuting every day and you're never there. So that not only is it like causing more sprawl into, you know, rural or, you know, more natural areas, but to me, and it's subjective, I think the user experience of living there is almost poor in the fact that it almost defeats having that idyllic lifestyle of a peaceful house where you can, you know, live.
You know, I'm a big fan of yards and stuff, and yeah. LA County doesn't have them. Maybe these people are ahead of the curve, you know, they have a lot of space inside. We spend all our time inside. And once we strap on VR headsets, hey, just clear out that whole interior. You got a whole little VR environment to walk around.
Right. Yeah. Well, Jason, go ahead.
That's a really interesting point, Dave. And I think, you know, where these discussions are going is what does VR and AR mean to what people want out of architecture, out of buildings, out of places, right? And so you can't help but talk about, and obviously Meta and Facebook aren't the first to do this, right? But I think recently they're the sort of most visible in terms of trying to create a quote unquote life in a virtual environment. And what does that mean to a McMansion? I mean, Joe, you bring up good points. Like, who are you trying to impress? Like, what is it for? What's the end game, right? And with VR getting to this, that's going to get to the point where fidelity, you know, could be at Matrix levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's that crazy to think that we're going to get to a point in the next 50 years where you might not be able to tell the difference. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to the way you live and to the physical environment?
Absolutely. And that, Jason, that is a perfect transition because I had a sucks or doesn't suck for you. And you just talked about it a little bit. The metaverse sucks, doesn't suck.
Yeah. And my question back would be in the theme of what we're talking about. Well, for whom, right? For whom does it suck or not suck? And I think, you know, if you're a person that can afford a $30 million house in Beverly Hills, the metaverse might not be such a great thing, right? Because you're kind of, you know, you're kind of, or the people that, I don't know if you've seen, I don't know, Brad, you have, but I think it's Iceland or Finland that ran the sort of counter ad to the metaverse.
Sure.
And it was sort of the parody of the metaverse ad where the guy's actually in water and he's like, you can feel the water. you know, if you're a person that can afford to travel to Finland or have a house in Finland, maybe the metaverse sucks. If you're a person that, you know, for whatever reason, you're living in a country or a system that you'll never be able to, you'll never be afforded those opportunities to experience those things, maybe the metaverse is great. I don't know.
You're assuming that the metaverse and capitalism will not collide and that those spaces will be available to everyone. I mean, we're already seeing with NFTs and stuff like that, you know, people can't afford certain affordances. So let's say you want to go to Finland or, you know, to, you know, Australia or in the ocean and swim, but you got to pay. You got to pay in the metaverse.
But so my question is why, right? And this is why my answer to the metaverse right now is sucks, is because we're, you know, in the beginning of, you know, the metaverse, quote unquote, right? And I kind of
hate terms, that term. What is it? It's just virtual reality, right?
It's Second Life, right? I mean, this is not a new thing, right? But let's call it what it is. Okay, we'll say that we're at the beginning of the metaverse and we're already introducing false scarcity. Monetization and the corporatization of this thing that could be free and perfect for everybody, right?
Well, but Brad, now I listened to your Spotify episode, and I have to call you out on something.
Okay.
So the reason why musicians aren't getting paid from Spotify is because they're not creating a false scarcity. Mm. So false scarcity, or let's say scarcity drives value, right?
Yeah.
So the reason why those musicians aren't getting paid is because the truth is, now look at Amazon selling books. Mm-hmm. So Amazon will charge you, you know, still $15-$16 a book. Now I don't know how much the authors are getting,
right?
But Amazon is pretending like a digital copy of the book is the same value as a physical copy of the book, right?
Okay.
Now I think in a way you can't have it both ways, right? If you create art, mm-hmm. that's going to be distributed digitally, how does the artist get compensated for that if there's no scarcity or a full? And this is where you get into NFTs and all this other discussion about, you know, you could say NFT is a full scarcity, right?
Because I do.
Yeah, right. But it's a mechanism for driving value. I'm not saying it's good or bad, mm-hmm. but I'm just saying it's a way to charge more for something that you couldn't ordinarily charge for because it's digital and because it can be distributed infinitely without further cost.
Yes, I am all for getting artists paid. Specifically for NFTs, you know, I do appreciate, like, I think that that's what's driving it right now is because I think that's what's driving it today. And it is already being bastardized and will continue to be further bastardized, where the artists themselves will not be the ones who are making out. And more, it's going to be corporations. I'll give you an example, like Louis Vuitton is designing virtual spaces and virtual products now, and they're selling those as NFTs. That's the future, guys. That's where we're headed.
That's now.
Those are going to be the content creators who are going to get the most visibility, have the most marketing visibility behind what they're marketing to, and you know, it's going to be driving what the false scarcity and what the monetization of the metaverse is by design by the outset, and right. That's why I am giving it a sucks for today until we can figure out a way to make it great for everybody.
I was gonna say, Brad, so what you're saying is the metaverse is going to be no different than the real verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Brad, we already have that in-app purchases. Think about it. We used to play video games. You'd buy the video game, you'd play it. It is great. Now it's like there's all these add-ons and stuff, and you can't beat the game the same way. You know, Joe might be able to beat the game because he paid $50 extra. You know what I mean? So it's like, we already started this. Like, it's just going into VR now.
You know, Dave, it's so funny because I didn't think about that. Because what I was thinking about was, oh, it's less expensive to build much less expensive to build multiple virtual environments than a real building. And I didn't even think of the fact this still, and it's still derivative of in a capitalist system. So of course there's going to be people that are going to want to maximize profits on that. And therefore it might be just as inaccessible as anything else. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Good stuff, guys.
Yeah. The Louis Vuitton store in the metaverse is going to be just as expensive as the Louis Vuitton store in Beverly Hills.
They should make it bottomless bags, you know, like you're selling.
There's already examples where the virtual purse costs more than the real purse.
Oh, my gosh. But
and
you
the real Louis Vuitton purse is a couple of grand, right? And the virtual one is more.
Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding.
Here's the thing. In their defense, it's kind of like a Captain Caveman bag. You could put anything in that purse, right? You could put your virtual house into your Louis Vuitton bag. I'm thinking I might buy one today now that you mentioned that.
It's funny because, you know, the value of a Louis Vuitton, or as I say to my wife, Louis Vuitton, historically, a brand like that, the value is driven by the brand recognition, but also the quality and craftsmanship of the object, right?
Thank you for bringing that up. I wanted to bring that up too.
There's two things that drive value with that. So that when you go to a virtual environment, the craft and quality of that product isn't a factor anymore. Now, you could say, oh, I could design a bit of it, but the truth is, it's gone, right? So the only thing that remains is distilled into a brand perception status symbol thing without the craft, which makes it a little bit more disgusting, right?
It makes it totally more disgusting. And by the way, guys, I am all for expensive quality made things.
Yes, he is.
Joe and I have this argument with Dave all the time, actually, I'm all for it. You should buy a watch, or something that is really well crafted, and the value is because it's well crafted.
Right.
And I'm all for that. I think that that's actually part of the problem with our society today is that we're buying cheap things that are poorly made that don't last. And that has so much impact, right? So I'm actually all for spending a little bit of money on a Louis Vuitton bag, for example, or a nice watch or something like that, or quality clothes that are going to last longer. But you take away that and you leave only what you just described, Jason, as, you know, the perceived brand value, and you take quality out of it. Oh my gosh, it becomes disgusting really quick.
Yeah, but Brad, if I could defend myself for a second there, I agree. When you put it that way, I agree with that. Quality, you know, is important, and I would buy quality, but I think a lot of people who buy these things, they're already buying it strictly for the brand. You know, like I worked at many moons ago, Goldman Sachs. These young associates would come in with these watches that I always rail against, and they're all trying to one-up each other. I don't think they're doing it because they're like, well, I want to give this to my grandchild. No, right. They're doing it to impress the shit out of the people above them, so they'll get promotions and they'll get more McMansions.
Right. And then the medium ground between the two of them is there is a price point where it gets ridiculous. And there's no point to it because sure. You know, mm-hmm. I could spend $5,000, buy a really, really nice watch, have it forever. Do I need a $50,000 watch?
Right.
No,
right.
There's no point where the quality, I think, justifies a $50,000. You know, mm-hmm. and if I buy a $50,000, somebody's going to buy a $100,000 watch because they're out there. Yes. You know, like yes. The impress level kind of really goes away very, very quickly.
Who wasn't hugged as a child? This is what I want to know in our society.
Like, a lot of people.
Just hug each other. Which are people?
Right.
That's all. Let's end on hugs.
Let's end on hugs. Speaking and magical. Of,
do we want to get into our unicorn moment? Some moments of UX Zen.
Why don't we open it up to our guest, Jason Slickoff? Do you have one today?
Yeah. You know, when you asked me, and the unicorn moment is the what doesn't suck, right? Like, what's an example of something good? Is that what the unicorn moment is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Brad, when you asked me about this, it got me thinking, and it's interesting, the first thing that popped into my mind, interestingly, was the Myelin Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. And why, you know, I don't know why that popped into my head, but, you know, after all our discussion about capitalist excess and bastardization mm-hmm. of the American dream, I just looked to that as something that when it was designed by Myelin, who was 21, a grad student at the time.
Wow.
So think about it, this time, all war memorials were huge statues and flags and things very, like, you know, proud. And she proposed basically, and I don't know if you guys have been to the Vietnam War Memorial, but basically, yeah, sure. She proposed a very simple cut in the landscape mm-hmm. with a wall, a black marble wall, with all of the names etched into it.
Yep.
In order in which they died in the war.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And so when she designed this, you know, there was a lot of resistance about that, right? That's not a war memorial. That's a depressing, you know, we don't want that. Mm-hmm. But it's beautiful, right? It's like, it's very simple. And talking about the user experience of someone that's lost someone that they've loved, walks down into this cut in the landscape and is able to put a piece of paper on the marble wall and get an impression of their loved one's name.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable, right? It's beautiful. Right.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's haunting. Mm-hmm. It's controversial. That's my bright spot, that a young Myelin could propose that. And then it was built. And then it's really, after the fact, regarded as one of the greatest war memorials ever built.
And talking about permanence, you know, I mean, that is permanence, not only from an architectural or from a design perspective, but also a permanence of the names and the remembrance and the sacrifice. Yeah. So that is just the perfect marriage. And by the way, also, thank you for giving her a name, Myelin, right? Because I've been to the Vietnam Memorial and, you know, I've never thought about that there was a designer responsible for it.
Right.
And, you know, I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners didn't know that it was the brainchild of Myelin.
Yeah. So, who is second generation Asian American? American and who obviously at that time got a lot of flack for that as well, right? Mm-hmm. You're having an Asian person design the Vietnam Memorial. How dare you?
Hmm. Or even just having a woman at that time design, but obviously the irony is.
Joseph, do you have a magical rainbow unicorn moment today?
Gosh, I don't really know if I could top that. I think we should end on that.
Who wants to go second, right? Like, God, man. I'm going to have to move this around in post.
It could be the McRib. I mean, that really...
almost Shamrock Shake time.
Just as valid.
Speaking of scarcity, right? They're brilliant. Like, it's like a scarcity. Disney. It's like our Disney video release.
Oh,
right?
My God. Dave, I buy into it. Like, I'm like, November? McRib. Okay.
Yeah. Shamrock Shakes, yes!
How about this? I can give a unicorn moment based on our conversation today of like how user experience is based on point of view. I just did my taxes and TurboTax worked really well for me, but the design usage of that must really suck for tax accountants. And the same thing for like travel sites must really stink for travel agents. And, you know, that we talked a lot today about the, you know, American culture shifting. And so really made me think about, you know, as simple as it was for me to log into that, punch in a couple of numbers, hit send, it's all taken care of. You know, it really is a perspective. It really matters about perspective. I mean, a lot of fewer accountants. That's one, you know, one fewer jobs we have out there. You know, fewer McMansions that can be bought, I guess. I don't, but no, no, but it, but from a perspective point of view, it, it definitely relates to what we were talking about earlier today.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, yeah, I've got one that I brought especially for Jason today. Jason and I went guitar shopping a couple of weeks ago, and he helped me buy a new Fender Telecaster guitar. That was a lot of fun.
Nice.
But after that, I bought a little device, and that's my unicorn moment today. It's called the Fender Mustang Micro Amp. Ooh. And it's a little tiny device that you plug its battery. No, it's chargeable by a USB-C. USB-C, and you plug it into your guitar. It's about 3 inches long, and then you plug in your headphones into that, and it's like a full amp kind of experience, and it just works really, really well, and has all these like presets. You can choose from, like, you know, a vintage sounding tube amp or something modern, and then it has the effects pedals all built in, and there's basically like two switches that you control everything from, and it's brilliantly designed and it works really well. And you know, for married guys like Jason and I can't like bust out like a big giant amp and just jam at 10 o'clock at night, which is when I play guitar. Yeah. So it's just a perfectly designed little product. So it's brilliant product design, very functional. And that's my unicorn moment.
Okay. So I got one. I got a good one, guys. Dating. Very good user experience, I'm finding, for a marriage. It's been a good 2 years.
What is it? Date? I'm not really.
I went on a date with the wife, and it was amazing. It was the standard issue, you know, dinner and a movie. And I have a second unicorn moment there. In that is in the town where we went to have this date, they had and this is actually a positive story about silver linings from the from COVID. Okay, so like a lot of villages and neighborhoods. And this goes back to our episode about architecture and designing for space. Like a lot of neighborhoods, they've pushed out their restaurants and their bars onto the streets, right? So you have outdoor dining. But they went a step further, and they actually closed off a couple sections of a main road.
Yeah.
Okay. Which I sat there, and it just hit me. This is the first time it hit me in this whole time that they've done this. I'm like, because I saw a lot of, it's a college town too. I saw a lot of college kids out. I saw a lot of community, a lot of, you know, everybody was happy. And I was like, this is a really positive use of space. And I hope they never open up this street again. Yeah. Like, I hope those structures stand, and I hope the community builds. And I hope when I come back 10 years from now, I hope it's doubled and tripled. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's a thriving kind of environment. And that's a beautiful thing from a bad situation. So
right.
I'd like to end on that note.
I love that.
Good UX in architecture and space.
Well, guys, I think we've done it. We've solved the unhoused situation. We solved the future of modern architecture. We've solved the metaverse, and we've done it all in about an hour and a half, I'd say. So that's our episode today. Jason Stoikoff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes,
and thanks to our users and to our listeners for listening to Sucks. We are wishing you health, a well-designed life, and good experience. I think we're still finding our sweet spot, and I think it's that we're unqualified morons.